at the end of the day, and so here's the caveat. The caveat is that as a part of their rules, all of the companies over the last 5 years have evolved the way they think about something like hate speech. So whereas, you know, early in their lives, the companies pretty much didn't take down much of anything, even, you know, kind of rancid, hateful comments, they've evolved their rules now so that, to be honest, they look a little bit more like human rights standards and European law than they look like First Amendment law. And this has actually created a problem in the United States, because when they come up with these rules around hate speech and actually apply them, you actually get conservatives in the United States saying there's some bias against conservatives. Whereas in Europe, that's exactly what they're pushing for, is more action, you know, against that kind of content.
I'm Quinta Jurecek, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 5th, 2019. Today, we're bringing you a new episode from our Arbiters of Truth series on disinformation in the run-up to the 2020 election. This week, Evelyn Dweck and I spoke to David Kaye, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression. He's argued that social media companies should adopt international human rights law as the standard for content moderation, an idea that has become increasingly popular in recent years. And he has a new book out, Speech Police: The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. We talked about international law, fake news, and the pitfalls and promises of internet governance. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 480, David Kaye on policing speech online.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me to be on.
So you are the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the right of freedom of opinion and expression, which is a bit of a mouthful, by the way. You were appointed in 2014. Let's start with something really basic. What is a United Nations Special Rapporteur?
Yeah, so a Special Rapporteurs, and there are about 50 of them between Special Rapporteurs and what they call working groups, are basically appointed by the Human Rights Council to monitor different areas of human rights around the world. Typically, we have global remits, but there are about a dozen special rapporteurs who have particular country mandates. And we visit countries, prepare reports on those countries, we communicate with governments, and we do thematic reports on issues that either have a kind of normative or an implementation focus on our particular areas of human rights law.
Great. And from an outsider perspective, it has appeared, is it fair to say that a focus of your time has been online speech and social media issues?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, one of the things when I came into the position in 2014 was, you know, it was clear that there was movement among governments to increasingly restrict speech online. So it was pretty obvious that the mandate itself was going to move in that direction. And I started with digital security issues, things like encryption. But right over the last 5 years, I would say the balance of the work, in part as a reaction to the way governments are behaving, has been focused on online behavior, online speech, telecommunication.
So when you started, did you expect that so much of your time was going to be focused on social media?
I don't think I did. So starting in 2014, I mean, if you think back to then, you know, some of the big issues that was, you know, I was appointed just about a year after the Snowden revelations. And as a matter of the human rights community, there was a real focus on government surveillance, in particular mass surveillance, bulk collection and issues like that. So it was clear to me that there was going to be a focus on the online space. But the fact that it became really focused on social media, you know, I imagine that that would become an issue because so much of our speech, even back then, only 5 years ago, was being moderated by these major platforms.
And so when you talk about so much of our speech being moderated by these major platforms, which has obviously become such a topical issue that's so much in focus these days. In your 2018 report to the Human Rights Council, you call for social media companies to use human rights by default in the way in which they moderate that speech. Can you unpack what you mean by that?
Yeah. So, I mean, to back up just a little bit, I mean, I think it's important to think about the role that social media companies play in, you know, in all the different jurisdictions or markets, however you want to think about it, around the world. You know, in a place like the United States, there's social media, but there's also other sources of information, other ways for people to get information. But in many parts of the world, social media has become, you know, tantamount to the internet for many places. It has displaced other sources of information and displaced the public square in many respects in many parts of the world. And so the responsibility in these markets is enormous. And in that light, since they have such an impact on the public and such an impact on individual rights to seek and receive information, it seemed clear to me that their responsibility should be understood not just as business entities, but as entities that are really engaged in moderating and even regulating speech. And so, you know, there's a network, there's a framework of how to think about business and human rights that the UN adopted several years ago called the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, also known as the Ruggie Principles, named after Professor John Ruggie, who developed them. And those provided for me a kind of nice and coherent way to think about the responsibilities of big companies when they have this impact on the public and have this impact on rights.
And so, I mean, I'm just interested because, you know, you talk about them being the public sphere in so many countries, which, you know, companies are often quite happy to sort of adopt that sort of framing as well because it magnifies their importance. But I wonder whether they are so happy about this sort of concomitant responsibility that you're talking about. How have you found that the company's response to that framing?
I think it's been an evolution. You know, the companies have, I think early on, they really resisted this framing. I mean, I think even 5 years ago or 4 years ago when I started having conversations with the companies, the idea that not merely that they had this impact, but the idea that they had a responsibility, I think was not top of mind for them. But, you know, the events of the last few years and some of the places where we've seen massive impact at a really, you know, significant level of harm, places like Myanmar, where Facebook, you know, clearly had a role in providing space for incitement to violence, to, you know, to real imminent violence. They've come to understand that they have this broader responsibility, but it's taken them a long time. I think it's taken them a long time to figure out even what their rules should look like and how they can, you know, protect not only their users, but protect the public. Certainly since Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, they've come to see that they do have this impact. But look, frankly, they're still resistant. They're resistant to government regulation. They're really quite resistant to any form of accountability. And so I think this is a kind of constant effort to get them to think about their responsibilities to the public. And human rights really just provides a framework to help them and to push them to think in that way.
Yeah, so let's dig into that a little more. So when you say that human rights provides a framework to help them think through these questions, just tell me more about what you mean by that, because I think that many of our listeners are Americans, and to Americans, when they hear that, they may think, what on earth are you talking about?
Absolutely. This is a constant issue for human rights lawyers and professionals in the United States. I think Evelyn can tell you that the conversation outside the United States is really different than the one here. You know, basically, let me back up just a little bit. The central treaty in human rights law that I work with is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR. It's drawn from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it's a binding treaty. The United States ratified it in 1992. And about 170 states are parties to it. So it's a really important treaty with a lot of parties to it. It's in its Article 19, It protects everyone's right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers and through any media. And at the same time, it provides states, because it's directed towards states, it provides states with the ability, recognizes their authority to restrict expression as long as it meets certain basic conditions of legality and necessity and proportionality and legitimacy of objective. My view is that even though this treaty and human rights law more generally typically applies to states, there is a role for the companies here to ensure that their users are protected in the exercise of the rights that they have. And we've seen so often in the last several years that the companies, in a way, are standing in between governments and their users. So when I talk about human rights implementation, I think we could think about it in two separate ways, which maybe we could dig into a little bit. You know, one way to think about it is, what should the companies do when governments demand that they take action against users or particular content? Should they be evaluating that content under human rights law and say to the government, well, we think this person has a right to say that? Or should they be saying, well, under your law, we understand that this should be taken down, so we'll do it. That's one way of thinking about their responsibility. And then the other is, putting aside all of the government demands, what should the companies be doing in terms of their rulemaking and their moderation of content? That is, moderating content, evaluating content for which governments aren't making demands, but they're still providing this space for that content. Those provide two different ways of thinking about the human rights obligations that they might have.
I can definitely attest to the conversation being a little bit different outside the United States. I mean, I've been in, not least a little less skeptical towards international human rights in general. I've been in rooms with you, David, where you've been putting this argument, and sort of the US legal community response can be sort of like, why are we talking about this? What are we talking about? So it's an interesting starting point. Talking about the sort of where the rubber hits the road for those platforms applying international human rights norms in their content moderation, how do we square that with the idea that we do want these platforms to take down some speech, and some of it may not be clearly outside the realms of free expression? Some of it, you know, for example, if a knitting site doesn't want political conversation on its platform, how does international human rights law intersect with that decision? Or what if more mainstream platforms don't want adult nudity on their platforms? How does international human rights law interact there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great question. And I think there are a couple of things to think about here. So one is, I tend to focus on the companies that have massive scale and reach, that have obvious impact on the public, on individual rights, and so forth. I think we need to be, as we think about the role of human rights law, I think we have to be mindful of the fact that, on the one hand, the massive companies have major impact on the ability of people to enjoy their rights in many parts of the world. And at the same time, smaller companies, smaller platforms like, you know, your knitting one or others like it, they also provide a space for individuals to exercise rights to free association. So in a sense, I mean, these aren't competing rights, but I think we need to be taking those into account when we're thinking about these rules. And so if you're one of these massive companies and you're thinking about basically what the UN guiding principles suggest, which is, you know, take into account, you know, do basic due diligence into how your rules will have an impact on human rights, I think you'll come up with different answers than in the context of your knitting community and their desire to create a space that is, you know, may not have the same kind of impact on the public and on individual rights. And it's more about creating a space for like-minded people or people with an affinity to share information and to share ideas. So I think it's important to distinguish those things. And I also think that it's important for us to, again, if we're applying and thinking about human rights standards, to recognize that human rights law doesn't provide a kind of, you know, sharp red line for any particular answer. And this, I think, is what is particularly maybe difficult for policymakers and decision makers and the companies themselves to grapple with. And that is, you know, there's this principle in European human rights law called the margin of appreciation, which basically says that, look, there's a global standard, but we recognize that there may be different implementation of that standard in different communities, in different, let's say, markets or jurisdictions. And I think that's an available tool for the companies to think about. You know, have a global standard, but recognize that there may be different ways of implementing that standard depending on the place that you're engaged in. I mean, that leads to other responsibilities of the companies, which we could talk about, like having a sense of that community where they are moderating content. But I think that the framework is flexible enough to allow global standards, but also variation, you know, from country to country.
So that's really interesting. Just to sort of clarify, what that means then is that applying international human rights norms won't necessarily be simpler for the platforms. So I guess we have this idea that if we're just applying local rules in each context, that might be difficult for platforms to operationalize. It might create friction, undesirable friction between markets. But what you're saying is that might even exist a little bit under these, what we call international human rights norms, which also have a sense of sort of localization because of the importance of context.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that context is important. You know, let's think about something like hate speech, right? So, you know, we've had a pretty robust debate over hate speech, you know, certainly since the massacre at the Walmart in El Paso, right? Where, you know, when we think about what kinds of rules the company should have when you're talking about somebody sharing, you know, a manifesto that's, you know, that's racist and incites violence, you know, to a certain extent, it's easy for the companies to think about context because, you know, they're here in Menlo Park or somewhere on the peninsula in San Francisco. They have a kind of shared, there's an inner subjectivity, let's say, about their, you know, their relationship to the users in that space. But then when you think out about all of the different places where they're operating, where context may be different, where the code that either kind of disguises the hate speech or really helps us understand and define what the speech may be, the companies have very little insight into these different places where they're operating. And so I think, I mean, I take your point. I think it's true that applying human rights standards does not simplify things for the companies. Because it does require evaluation of context. It requires them to be closer to their users, which is something they don't really do right now. They're very distant from their users. They may be hiring, you know, tens of thousands of moderators and particularly language experts in different places, but how close are they really to the communities where they're operating, so that they can make the distinctions between hate speech and just, you know, vigorous political debate? They hardly have the tools to do that.
So I'll continue to play the role of the sort of skeptical American here and just ask, when we're considering the difference between a more First Amendment-based approach, which seems to be where many of these companies sort of began, and the more international human rights approach that you're advocating, what do you see as the biggest difference? And is the difference, in your view, bigger or smaller than most people might expect?
It's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, most of these companies, you know, they've been kind of marinated in First Amendment law. I mean, their general counsels, their policy people who do content work, you know, by and large, although they have, you know, foreign lawyers, people outside the United States, but by and large, they are, you know, they're coming from a First Amendment culture that is extremely protective of all sorts of speech. And we know that the standard for restricting, you know, what we might call loosely hate speech, you know, is extremely high because it has to be more or less incitement to imminent violence. It's just a very high standard. And that's very different from, well, it's very different from the human rights standard. It's very different from the standard in Europe, where, it's not only incitement to imminent violence, but basically advocacy of hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination or hostility or violence can be regulated by the state. And so, you know, the public really has demands on companies in, I mean, if we're just using the example of Europe, that are rooted in their law, rooted in their tradition, certainly since the Second World War and since the Holocaust, of recognizing that some speech can have, you know, real direct harms. And so I think that's a place where we can explore the distinctions between a First Amendment approach and a human rights oriented approach. At the end of the day, and so here's the caveat. The caveat is that as a part of their rules, all of the companies over the last 5 years have evolved the way they think about something like hate speech. So whereas, you know, early in their lives, the companies pretty much didn't take down much of anything, even, you know, kind of rancid, hateful comments. They've evolved their rules now so that, to be honest, they look a little bit more like human rights standards and European law than they look like First Amendment law. And this has actually created a problem in the United States, because when they come up with these rules around hate speech and actually apply them, you actually get conservatives in the United States saying there's some bias against conservatives. Whereas in Europe, that's exactly what they're pushing for, is more action, you know, against that kind of content.
That gets to something that Evelyn and I have actually talked about a lot. As you say, it does kind of feel like the United States post 2016 is sort of catching up to the rest of the world in a way. Sort of there is this kind of realization that imminent lawless action may be a little too far in terms of what speech you want to start regulating. So, I mean, you've been doing this for a while, as you've said. Have you seen any shift in attitudes within the United States to your own advocacy of taking an international law approach over time? Are people more open to that approach now than they might have been in 2014, 2015?
I think so. I mean, there's different kinds of communities that we're interested in here. And, you know, if we're thinking about the companies as the first, I wouldn't say the first audience of some of my reporting on content moderation, the companies have definitely woken up, let's say, to the idea that human rights as a standard can be helpful to them, certainly helpful to them in the way they think about their role in markets, in jurisdictions around the world. You know, Twitter and Facebook have hired human rights specialists. They actually, Facebook recently brought on board a human rights director, somebody who is responsible for evaluating, although I can't say everything that they're responsible for because I'm not sure, but is basically responsible for evaluating Facebook policies in terms of content in keeping with human rights obligations and human rights of their users and human rights impact of the company. So, at least as far as that audience goes, I think there is a move towards understanding and deploying the language of human rights in their work. So that's one way of thinking about it. The broader community of people, you know, I still think, and, you know, I kind of, as Evelyn knows, I kind of proselytize for human rights language as being a part of the debate in the United States. I still think we're far behind the rest of the world in deploying, at least in the democratic world, in deploying human rights language and human rights standards as tools for understanding what the companies are doing and what they should be doing. And that's a problem, I think, because it does create a barrier, certainly when we think about how, for example, Americans should be thinking about what, let's say, Europeans are doing and how what Europeans are doing in terms of regulating the space for social media might have a long-term impact on the way the social media companies moderate content, even in the United States. I think there's this barrier. And my hope is that, in a way, I mean, it's this kind of silver lining around the whole debate, is that because the companies do have this impact and do have this role, there will be an increasing understanding in the United States that that we need to also understand at least the vocabulary of human rights to participate in these global debates in a way that doesn't keep us in this exceptional category.
So one of the things that we're interested in exploring a little bit more in depth on this podcast, and in particular in the lead into 2020, is the issue of disinformation, propaganda, foreign interference in elections. You were fairly early in issuing a joint declaration on freedom of expression and fake news, disinformation and propaganda with a number of other international human rights representatives in March 2017, so sort of shortly after the 2016 election. Can you describe how that came about, the issuing of that declaration?
Sure. So we do this every year. This is my mandate, so the UN mandate, the UN Special Rapporteur, and my counterparts in the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. OSCE has a representative on freedom of the media. There's a Special Rapporteur on freedom of expression also in the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights and the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. So the four of us do this annual declaration. And, you know, it was clear after the election in 2016 and also after Brexit that there was this, let's say, scourge of disinformation. And it was being, I mean, our concern was really twofold. On the one hand, there was a genuine concern, and I think still is a genuine concern, that disinformation, particularly when it is pushed by governmental actors, disinformation has a kind of censorship role. It's designed in many respects to crowd out and to sow doubt in people's minds about verifiable information. That's a significant problem. It's a significant problem for the information space. Generally, it's obviously a significant problem for democracies as they're trying to, you know, basically make decisions rooted in facts. On the other hand, the idea of, let's say, fake news or disinformation or dissemination of false information, that has been a category of restriction in authoritarian governments for many, many years. It's very common for governments to have rules on the books that criminalize the dissemination of false information, and those rules are typically used in order to silence dissidents, political opposition, journalists, and others. So we thought it was important to put out a statement, basically a joint declaration, that on the one hand recognizes the harms of disinformation, but also says, look, as you are, you know, as you companies or as governments are aiming to occupy this space and impose some regulation or moderation, be careful. You don't want to create norms that can be abused by authoritarians. You don't want to create norms, putting aside authoritarians, that can be abused by governments, you know, like the U.S. government right now, which obviously, you know, the president would love to have rules that allows him to regulate the media in a very robust content way. You know, you don't want to have rules that allow them to do that. So we laid out a set of principles to try to shape how people think about this space.
And so walk me through those principles. What do you think is most important?
Yeah. So I think the first set of principles, I mean, we had two audiences, basically, or two targets for this, right? So the first set of principles goes toward governments. And I think we, meaning myself and my colleagues, my counterparts, had a strong belief that rules against false information are not per se unlawful, but, you know, are extremely difficult to defend as a matter of human rights law, particularly because they fail the necessity and proportionality standards that are part of the freedom of expression and the restriction that's possible under the freedom of expression. So we laid out essentially a set of principles that were rooted in Article 19 of the ICCPR and more or less said false information laws are deeply problematic. And then for the companies, I mean, basically we said, look, focusing on content will be just as problematic for you as it would be for governments. And so it's important to think about tools other than restriction and think about tools that are more technologically oriented, that might be more oriented towards providing education and transparency to users so that they can more clearly identify where information is coming from. There could be rules that are similar to the control, for example, of spam that deal with the dissemination and reach of information. None of that makes it any easier to decide, you know, what is the kind of information that should be restricted or subject to even those kind of technological kind of frameworks. But that's the direction. Those were the kind of principles that we were trying to push companies and governments towards.
And so one of the things I find interesting here is Article 19, as you reference, describes this idea of freedom of expression regardless of frontiers. Mm-hmm. And that interacts interestingly with the sort of the notion of sovereignty, of the right to non-interference by other countries in nations' domestic political affairs. I think this discussion around what these big tech companies mean for sovereignty has been something that I've been really interested in. And I wonder what your thoughts might be on what international law has to tell us about that conversation.
Yeah, that is, I mean, I think that's one of the fundamental questions here. And it's, in a way, it's why I think human rights law can be helpful, why international law can be helpful. So to back up just slightly, you know, all of the companies have rules not only for the moderation of content on the platform, you know, their own company rules as to sort of how they see their brand, but they all also say that we will observe local law. And I think that's a kind of reflection. I mean, you could look at it in the cynical way that that's just a reflection of their desire to have advertisers in that market and have users in that market. But it's also, I think, a reflection of the fact that the way the international system is organized is that, you know, territory and jurisdiction still matter. I mean, this is something that Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu identified in like 2005, 2006, when they wrote a book about the governance of the internet. And so that idea is, you know, it persists, and international law recognizes that, you know, states have that kind of authority. The thing is, and here's where human rights law, I think, is interesting and provides a distinction, is exactly that clause that you mentioned, the regardless of frontiers. You know, there's been this debate among human rights lawyers and academics and governments over the years as to whether the ICCPR has extraterritorial effect. You know, in other words, you know, to what extent does, let's say, U.S. responsibility under the ICCPR apply outside of its borders? So when the U.S. is operating in, say, you know, Europe or Iraq or Syria, you name it, you know, do human rights laws bind it? That's an interesting question for another podcast, let's say. But what the ICCPR in Article 19 says is that the right to freedom of expression extends across borders. It's regardless of frontiers. It's kind of an extraterritorial right, which is, you know, very different than the other rights that we see in human rights law. And so, you know, the question of what users in different jurisdictions can get access to, as a matter of human rights law, it means they should be able to have access to information from wherever it's coming, right? Wherever it's coming from, individuals should have access to it. And that comes into conflict with that sovereignty notion that states can adopt their own rules and regulate their own public space. I mean, there's a clear conflict there, but I think, one of the reasons why human rights law standards can be so valuable is that they provide a tool both for users and for the companies, frankly, to push back against restrictions that any government might impose that are seeking to limit the ability of their users to get information. I think that's a value. It's kind of a tool that companies and users can use in light of the traditional arguments around sovereignty.
So you issued this statement, I guess it's a little over 2 years ago now, and 2 years has passed. I think maybe we're past a little bit of this hysteria that was around in that time about fake news and Macedonian teenagers disrupting elections everywhere. But I'm wondering if, from your perspective, the sort of the warnings that you know, made in that statement, have they been heeded, or what has changed? If you were to issue a similar statement now, what would you be focusing on?
Yeah, I'm heartened by some things and disheartened by others. You know, on the positive side of the ledger, you know, I think that, you know, if you look at, I mean, the place where most of these conversations are happening in what I would say is a kind of in an atmosphere of open debate is in Europe. I mean, the outcomes aren't always that great, but particularly around issues of disinformation, if you look at the process in Brussels, I was really concerned because the European Commission started up what they called a high-level panel or high-level group on disinformation shortly after the election of Trump. And I was concerned that that high-level panel would lead the commission, as some of its commissioners were urging, would lead it to adopt rules that were, you know, frankly, extremely restrictive on the sharing of information, and that would put the commission in the category or in the position of saying, you know, this kind of information is true and this kind of information is untrue. That is not a place that I think we want governments to be. And I was very worried about that. But the truth is that the European Commission actually moved in a relatively positive direction. And so this was in basically 2017, 2018, they actually developed a set of rules that, instead of looking at a restriction and criminalization, tended to focus on saying to both companies and to governments, you need to develop tools of transparency, develop tools of media literacy and education, you know, pushing the companies toward, you know, thinking about the technical features that they can innovate so that they can make it harder to share disinformation and to identify disinformation, to make that part easier. So that part has been, you know, pretty hopeful. I mean, on the negative side, you know, of course, we still have, you know, people like Donald Trump and others pushing for, or at least creating this narrative of fake news, you know, and pushing for regulation of the media and creating this, you know, strongly politicized orientation around what social media is doing. And I think that's problematic, because if we think of this in this highly charged, politicized environment, on the one hand, it's going to be hard for the companies to do anything, but it's also going to be hard for governments, certainly in the United States, to do smart regulation, to regulate not around the content, but around areas like transparency, so that we can actually have a sense of what the companies are doing and have a debate with the companies that's open and on the basis of shared information. So I, you know, the way I see it is there's both positive and negative things happening out there. You know, I'm not really confident that the companies are getting it right now, or even that they're focusing on the right things. I mean, one thing that's clear, and we saw this in the European context, is that the companies are extremely resistant to any evaluation of their business model. And so it's clear that disinformation, you know, it really is something that flourishes in an environment of, you know, of the attention economy. And that's something that certainly consumer rights organizations in Europe are anxious about and are lobbying for rules around, but there's very little action around that.
And do you have any sense or indication of why the commission didn't sort of take the path that you were fearing and sort of stayed its hand? I mean, we see so many governments around the world at the moment reaching, grasping for tools to sort of control their information space. Is it too naive to think that it was a concern about the human rights issues that you're raising, or what do you think came into play there?
Yeah, I don't know if I can diagnose it precisely, but I think that there was enough. I mean, there were two kinds of concerns that were raised in the context of the European debate. So on the one hand, there's this persistent concern that the more power for evaluating content that you put into the hands of, you know, these major American companies, paradoxically, the stronger they'll become, because they'll be the only ones who are able to, you know, to develop the tools, you know, with their massive resources to deal with this kind of problem. And it will be harder if there are generalized rules for maybe innovative new startups in the European space to develop. And I think many European policymakers came to understand that even though they want the companies to have stronger rules, that that might have this negative impact on innovation across Europe. I think that's one possibility. I mean, the other possibility is that there's a kind of coalition of journalists, of human rights activists, of members of the European Parliament and the Commission itself that really saw, in ways that they don't see the hate speech and terrorist content debates, they really saw efforts to restrict disinformation as being liable to really restricting the sharing of legitimate, let's call it legitimate, or we could say verifiable information, and could also be seen as a tool by other governments to really restrict information. So if you think about 2017, this was exactly the time where Malaysia in its last government was adopting an anti-fake news law. And Europeans saw that, and they saw that in Malaysia, or just as earlier this year in Singapore. They see that countries are looking to the European debate and are saying, oh, there's this great concern over fake news. We should take action just like they are. We should take action that is strong and, you know, tells the companies you need to deal with this kind of content, and we're going to criminalize you if you don't. And I think that kind of freaked out some of the Europeans, to be honest, as to, you know, the use of or the misuse or the abuse of their debate in places overseas where they did care about that.
So let's talk about your recent book, which is called Speech Police, The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet. You kind of center the book around this question of who is in charge. So just let's start from the basics. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, do we really know who we want to be in charge of regulating speech? You know, do we want it to be the companies, which, you know, again, have massive power? Or do we want it to be governments controlling, you know, the public square, if we want to consider it the public square? I mean, my sense is that we haven't really figured out who we want to be in charge of making those rules. In the United States, traditionally, that's not something for government to do. I mean, as you know, we started out at the beginning, you know, First Amendment basically says, you know, government shouldn't be regulating content. And in Europe, they see things differently. So there's a real, you know, a real disconnect as to who we, certainly in the democratic world, think should be making these rules, who should decide what the rules are and who should implement them.
And do you have an answer?
Oh, I didn't think you were going to ask that. I think part of my answer is government should be more involved. Government regulation is completely warranted. But what that government regulation might be, to my mind, should not be content focused, at least not as a first step. I mean, I would really like to see governments essentially regulate more transparency. I think unless the companies are required to be more transparent about their rulemaking process, the implementation of their rules, you know, if they, the sort of the case law, if we could call it that, around their decisions, until they have requirements to be more transparent, I don't think they will be more transparent. And so, you know, I think that's a totally viable space for governments to enter. I don't think governments should be deciding, again, the specific rules, but I do think that companies, if they apply human rights standards, are certainly in a better position to make decisions. And that kind of decision making that's rooted in human rights standards would also involve transparency, better process, rules that are reflective of what their users, you know, are guaranteed under the law.
So I completely loved this book. I actually think it's a real public service. So thank you for writing it. I can't think of a better sort of accessible, short. It's short, everyone. You should read it. It's a very broad summary of the recent history and developments in this area, and really bringing in that the global considerations that often get overlooked. And a really valuable part of it is the case studies that you bring in from all around the world. And I wondered if we could just maybe talk about one that's sort of a pet interest of mine that we don't talk about very often, but that's the case study of Singapore, which you write about in the book. So can you maybe tell us a little bit about what's happening in Singapore?
Sure. So, you know, Singapore is not, as probably a lot of your listeners know, you know, it's a dynamic economy and all that, but it's not what I would call a free speech nirvana. It's also not entirely repressive. I mean, there's a free media in Singapore, more or less. There are innovators among journalists and others, but they have very strict free speech rules, and that lead to sometimes prosecutions of journalists under defamation rules that are outdated and so forth. In any event, Singapore does not have and hasn't had a, let's call it, a fake news problem, but they kind of jumped onto the fake news bandwagon. And earlier this year, they adopted, you know, after a kind of open process that was led by their parliament, they adopted a law that criminalizes basically the dissemination of false information. And it's particularly focused on online information. And what I thought was really interesting about the process that led to it was, if you can pull up all of the hearings and the transcripts of the hearings. And there was one hearing in particular where a journalist, Kirsten Hahn, was before the committee, and one of the committee members, a senator, was basically grilling her about her views on a Human Rights Watch report. And basically, in the context of this back and forth between the senator and Kirsten Hahn, it became clear that this senator saw, you know, the kind of criticisms made by Human Rights Watch in this report about Singapore as constituting false information, basically false information that could be regulated by the state. And that's a real concern, right? Because human rights organizations, just like journalists, are very often involved in doing fact finding. Usually that's pretty rigorous, or at least we hope it would be rigorous, and can lead to criticism of government. And it became clear that the idea, the motivation behind this law, in part was, how do we protect the government, right? How do we protect the government and government policy in the face of criticism? And that's exactly the kind of false information law that I think is deeply problematic, interferes with freedom of expression and the underlying ideas of promoting robust debate. And if that is the model, and, you know, as a footnote here, Singapore has been involved in this this kind of UK initiative that brought together several countries in thinking about disinformation. If that's the way forward, that is a really problematic future for us in thinking about the role that governments play in dealing with disinformation.
Totally. And this is one of the reasons why I find it such an interesting case study, because you can almost, and I don't say this often, but you can feel a bit of sympathy for the companies in the position that they're put in when, you know, sort of the process that Singapore followed for passing this law had all of the indicia that we normally associate with good lawmaking procedure. It had open hearings. It produced a report of several, you know, 100 pages describing why this law was necessary. But, you know, as you put it very generously, it's not a nirvana of free speech sort of environment. And it really raises this question of, how do companies decide what governments they should be responsive to? And like you mentioned, the International Grand Committee on Disinformation and Fake News, which Mark Zuckerberg has copped a lot of flack for refusing to appear before and refusing to respond to subpoenas. But it is this difficult tension that you feel of, you know, should companies be responding to these governments that have these sort of authoritarian demands? But they obviously have to respond to some governments. And do we really want companies deciding what laws legitimate? Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about how you feel about the International Grand Committee proceedings that are happening.
Yeah, I mean, so I think you raised just a really, the way you put it is really precisely correct. I mean, from my perspective, just to go back to the human rights standards part of it, because, you know, Singapore is not alone. You know, Turkey, which, you know, has shut down Wikipedia in Turkey for over 2 years now. I mean, this is not a kind of unusual situation for the companies to be in. And one of the reasons why I think human rights law standards can be valuable is, like, putting aside the normative presence of human rights law. Right now, when the companies go to government and try to resist government interference, you know, what is their argument? We have company rules, or we have business interests. I mean, I think if they say across the board, they apply human rights standards, particularly because they're trying to protect their users and to protect, let's say, the public in Singapore and to protect its rights, you know, that, to my mind, that is a better place for the companies to be, rather than just relying on their kind of company standards. But as far as this grand committee goes, like, I have no problem. In fact, I encourage this kind of, you know, coalition of governments to be thinking about what's a genuine problem. I mean, disinformation is a genuine problem. I think one of the problems, however, with having a grand coalition that includes, you know, democracies like the UK and Canada, along with a, you know, a partly free country like Singapore, partly free being the Freedom House evaluation, the problem is, you know, you end up with at least the pressure or the potential to move more in the direction of Singapore than in the direction of, you know, human rights law. And that, to my mind, that should be of real concern. And so in that particular context, I don't know where they'll end up. I mean, I'm afraid that those kinds of coalitions will lead to pressure on the companies to take down content that really, you know, shouldn't be taken down, or will simply, you know, provide a cover for governments like Singapore to take pretty harsh actions against government criticism.
So on that note, let me sort of zoom out a little bit as we wrap up and ask, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the way that things are going, the direction the world is headed on speech issues, and specifically on, you know, as we've been talking about, social media content moderation?
Yeah, I mean, optimistic or pessimistic, I suppose I'm somewhere in between, but by and large, I have a pretty heavy dose of pessimism about where we're heading. And that's because, I mean, it's because of a few things. On the one hand, I think, notwithstanding the fact that in Brussels, in particular, there's been a resistance to the most dangerous kinds of government regulation of content, there are moves, you know, in Paris, in London, in Germany, and so in Berlin, to impose increasing pressure on the companies to regulate content. And again, my fear of that is that locks in the power of the companies as decision makers, and it locks in their basic dominance of online space in Europe, and that's a kind of reality that we see in many parts of the world. So I mean, that kind of creates pessimism for me. And the pessimism I see in the United States is that, you know, our debate is extremely politicized. You know, if you go back to any of the hearings on the Hill that have brought up some of the, you know, the company representatives and brought them into hearing rooms, and I talk about one of these hearings in the book, you know, we see repeatedly just this incredible politicization of this space. And I don't think there's a real seriousness about regulating the companies. I mean, there might be around privacy, but there is not around content. So that leaves me pretty pessimistic. I mean, one of the, I guess, unusual things, I am not a proponent of the companies or a cheerleader for them by any measure, but I do think that public pressure has really led the companies to be more mindful of their responsibilities to the public. I don't think they're doing what they need to be doing. I don't think they've invested what they need to in terms of getting closer to the communities where they moderate content, where they're so powerful. But I think at the very least, we're starting to see some kind of movement by them to recognize their overwhelming power and the need to have standards that aren't just rooted in company rules, but are rooted in some human rights. So there's an element of optimism there, but it doesn't go far enough to outweigh the pessimism I see more generally around the world on these issues.
Yeah, that's fair. I think I would definitely put myself in the pessimistic category personally. But let me go back to what you say about sort of how companies seem to really be moving to some extent toward at least some conception of greater responsibility. You also mentioned that the political environment in the United States is sort of set up so that it's very hard for companies to act responsibly in that way. In your view, is the political environment in the United States, where there's sort of constant criticism from the president and his party, is that something that is going to really hamstring companies from making significant changes? Or in your view, sort of zooming out, looking at a more international context, is that something they can kind of push through if they're thinking of themselves as actors that are not American but have effects around the globe?
Yeah, that's a really great point. I mean, I think the companies are, and I should emphasize, I think this is kind of a corner office problem, because the people doing content policy, I think, want to get this right by and large. I think that the companies have been extremely weak and have been, you know, they've just failed to come to terms with the fact that they themselves, I mean, they are platforms of manipulation. They're being manipulated by politicians. They're being manipulated, obviously, by foreign governments. They have woken up way too late to the way in which they're manipulated, both as a political matter and as a kind of platform content matter. And so, I mean, that part of it makes me really pessimistic. They're extremely defensive. If you go back and look at the ways that Mark Zuckerberg responded in 2016 to the claims of disinformation on the platform up until today, it's always been defensive. It's never been forward leaning. And now, you know, we see the problems. I mean, they're fighting a kind of, you know, rear guard action against, you know, coordinated inauthentic behavior. And the people making those rules, they're great. They're doing the right thing. But the company as a whole has failed, it seems. And I think this is true of YouTube and Twitter as well. They simply failed to figure out how to deal with these problems. And if you layer on top of that the political framework in the United States, where you have conservatives, you know, led by the White House, but involving others too, you know, constantly complaining about bias against conservatives, they're like deer in the headlight. They don't know how to respond. And part of that is because they still want to be massive, you know, ATMs for their shareholders. Maybe sort of the global framework, like to the extent that the companies, you know, whose, you know, vast majority of users are outside the United States now, to the extent that they could, you know, reframe themselves as global companies rather than simply American companies, maybe that would help them. And maybe rooting their standards in human rights can be a part of that. But I have not seen them really step up in an open and honest way to answer any of these broader political questions in a way that gives me real hope.
Okay, so that's all fairly depressing. Let's try and end on a little bit of a high note and give us something to look forward to. What are you working on next?
So the project I'm working on right now is on hate speech. You know, that minor...
Great, easy, super. This is going to be... You're going to solve everything for us.
Well, I mean, so I think the companies and, you know, and Americans, you know, who are thinking about this, I think rightly ask, okay... So you're arguing for human rights standards. What does that really mean for an issue like hate speech or disinformation? Like, if you actually think about that as a content area, what would human rights law offer to the companies in making these decisions in a way that is more sustainable. And so what I'm trying to do this is my report for the General Assembly, which I am late on, which is due in October. That's when I report to the General Assembly. That report will try to cover that space. I mean, I'm interested in pushing the companies as much as possible to think about their global role, because I do think that even though they do have an impact in the United States that can be, you know, frankly, quite negative, although sometimes positive, that their global role is even more concerning. And I want them to be thinking about that. I mean, I could end on one little positive note, you know, rather than, you know, just always disrespecting the companies. You know, one thing to keep in mind is that, so just to give you an example, in a place like Cambodia, where the media is basically state dominated, it's, you know, the public media is state media. How do people get information? I was in Cambodia about a year ago, and one of the things that really struck me was I was in the car with a driver, and, you know, just doing some tourism, and he started talking about how he really disliked the government, and he was somewhat specific about the things he didn't like. And I said, well, where do you get your information given that the media is so dominated by the state? And without missing a beat, he said Facebook. You know, so these platforms offer something to people around the world. There's no question about that. And I think the real trick for us moving forward is it possible to preserve any of that good stuff while dealing with this bad stuff, the dissemination of disinformation, the manipulation, the dominance of a few companies, you know, in jurisdictions and markets around the world where people have very little input? You know, are those things, can those things coexist? And I think that, you know, we really can't ignore it. It's a major issue of public policy. The companies are not going away. So we need to think about both the positive aspects as well as the negative things that the companies are doing.
Well, that's great. And we won't take up any more of your time if you're already late on the report on this pressing issue, but we'll just have to have you back on. And Quinta and I can go good cop and bad cop with the US skeptic over there, grilling you on whatever you come up with. So thank you very much for your time today, David.
Thanks so much. This was fun.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. You've been listening to the fifth episode of Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare Podcast's new mini-series on disinformation. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare Podcast feed, and remember to check for new episodes every Thursday. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to David Kay. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and our producer is Jen Patya Howell. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. And as always, thanks for listening.